Understanding melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. The Melanoma Research Foundation estimates that 178,000 Americans will be diagnosed with melanoma this year, and approximately 10,000 people will die of it. Your chance of surviving melanoma is strongly linked to how early it's detected, so experts advise people to be vigilant about looking for signs of melanoma. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn who's at greatest risk for melanoma, what those signs are, and what kind of treatments are available. We'll discuss preventative measures, promising new research, and the possibility of a melanoma vaccine. And we'll hear from well-known newspaper columnist Bill Nemitz, who has written about his diagnosis of melanoma. He has been fighting it for more than 3 years now. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The most dangerous kind of skin cancer is melanoma, and yet it is not very well understood. We know it's wise to avoid sunburn and to watch for the appearance of unusual moles, but there's much more to this potentially deadly form of cancer. Today, we'll learn about the risks, diagnosis, and treatment of melanoma. Joining me in our studio, Dr. Frederick Aronson. He is an oncologist with New England Cancer Specialists. Dr. Carmen Rinaldi is a dermatopathologist, I learned a new word today, with Dermatology Associates. And Bill Nemitz is a columnist for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram and is currently undergoing treatment for melanoma. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about signs or symptoms of melanoma? Do you have questions about preventative measures? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Aronson, I'll start with you. I think many people believe melanoma is not as serious as many other kinds of cancer. People think of skin cancers generally as not being as serious. Maybe just a mole needs to be removed. Tell us about melanoma and how serious it is.
Yeah, so I expect that the reason people might feel that is that skin cancer is very common in general, but the vast majority of skin cancer is not melanoma. So the problem is that melanoma as a skin cancer is very dangerous. There are roughly 90,000 people in the U.S. being diagnosed with melanoma this year. That's invasive into their skin. Another 80 or 90,000 where it's there but hasn't invaded yet. Here in Maine, roughly 400 invasive and a similar number of non-invasive melanomas. So there's a fair amount of it. And if it spreads beyond the skin to the lymph nodes or to other organs, it is often fatal. Historically, it was almost always fatal. And we're very fortunate in the last 10, 20 years to have made dramatic progress in treating the disease when it's beyond the cure by surgery.
What is the difference between a melanoma and a basal cell carcinoma? Is it something that looks different, or is that something you can only find by testing it?
So usually they look different, and I would defer to Dr. Rinaldi, okay, who's not only a dermatopathologist but also a dermatologist, and so he can tell you what the lesions look like. I almost always see the patients after the lesion has been removed, which is nice for me. I learn about these things because I have to speak and teach and things like that.
Sure. So why don't you tell us, Dr. Rinaldi, what is the difference if you see something on your skin? What is the difference between, what does a melanoma look like as opposed to another more common form of skin cancer?
So classically, melanoma is a pigmented skin lesion, and it has a few characteristics different than the common mole. So melanomas, what you want to look out for is asymmetry, one half not looking like the other, border irregularity, notch or edge borders, color variation, and large diameter. The other thing we say is evolution or change. And other forms of skin cancer can overlap with that, but traditionally, those are the characteristics meant for melanoma. Other forms of skin cancers are non-healing sores or changing areas or red bumps that don't go away or bleed.
And my understanding, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that the earlier you catch it, the greater someone's chances of survival are. So it really isn't something where if you see something that is concerning to you, you think to yourself, oh, maybe I'll just watch this for a little while and see if it changes.
Well, that's exactly right. So melanoma is nearly 100% curable if caught in early stages. And as Dr. Aronson had mentioned, if it spreads, particularly to distant organs, it is quite deadly.
Okay. Bill, I thank you so much for being here. You
Great
know,
to
so
be here.
Many of us are moved by your column more than 3 years ago when you were first diagnosed. Tell us about your journey.
Well, actually, it was 2 years ago, January. And I had been treated for another cancer for about 12 years, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and was doing very well on that. It was indolent, and I'd had chemo once, but life was pretty normal. And then I developed this pain under my arm that I initially thought, well, it must be part of the CLL. And one thing led to another. It was biopsied, and I had a previous doctor who was dealing with my CLL. And once they realized it was melanoma, I walked into Dr. Aronson's office and became his patient.
Was there a dark spot or a
mole? Well, that was kind of a mystery in my case because I think it was back in the late 1990s. I had been to my family doc for a regular checkup, and I had had this dark spot on my chest, which we always mentioned but never did anything about. And finally, one time he said, "You know, it's a little bigger. What, you want me to take it off?" I said, "When?" He says, "Right now." So he removed it, and it was biopsied. And I think, if I recall, the report made reference to clean margins, but some area of doubt, and this should be basically, we should keep an eye on this, which of course went in one ear and out the other, especially since I was dealing with the other cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect it was probably rooted in that. It's not far from my axilla where things really acted up with the lymph nodes, but melanoma as a diagnosis kind of came out of left field for me.
And you kind of threw the book at it, didn't you, Dr. Aronson and Bill? You guys...
So in Bill's case, we don't know where it started for sure. It might have started in the skin. I would point out about 90% of melanoma starts in the skin, some in the eye, some in internal lining surfaces, and some about 2%. It shows up somewhere in the lymph nodes or elsewhere, and we don't know where it started. And so Bill fits into that category, although maybe the skin lesion was the source. So we threw the book at it. So in Bill's case, the cancer was not just under his arm. It was also in his intestine and in his lung and
brain.
And in the brain.
Mm.
So he required very aggressive surgical radiation and then medical oncology treatment.
And one heck of a stomach operation.
Yes, indeed. That was part of the surgery.
That's right. That was not fun.
And tell me about the time since then, the 2.5 years.
Well, what happened was I began treatment right then, and that carried through between the surgery, the radiation, and subsequent immunotherapy, which I'm sure we'll get into a little later. The immunotherapy lasted into March of 2016, which is a little more than a year after I had been diagnosed. And we had to suspend the immunotherapy at that time because of side effects that were becoming too onerous. Life wasn't good. And we decided to take a break from the immunotherapy until things settled down. But then upon further scans, 4 to 6 weeks later, there was a consensus that I was doing so well that I didn't require any more treatment for the time being. So I went 2 years that way. And now recently a lymph node in my abdomen has blown up, and I'm just completing targeted radiation treatment for that, and we'll embark on immunotherapy again next week.
You seem to have a lot of energy and be in good spirits for someone undergoing radiation, Bill.
I'm on borrowed time. What can I say? I mean, it's really been an amazing experience because there were times when I thought, this is it. And Dr. Aronson and I had a couple of very brutally frank conversations about that. So I'm still amazed I'm still here, And so as I prepare for this next round, I have the benefit of having been through it once before. I also have the benefit of it having worked quite well for me. And there are for me, ample indications that I should fare as well on the second time around.
Dr. Aronson, at the very beginning of the program, you said the good news is this is so much more treatable than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Is Bill an example of what you mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If he'd shown up on my doorstep 10 years earlier, we would have been in big, big, big trouble, and I don't think he'd be here today. Back when I got started in all of this back in the 1980s, I don't want to sort of get into how old I am, but we were just opening the door on modern immunotherapy, and the result of 10 years of hard work by myself and hundreds of people around the country and others around the world was we cured about 5 to 10% of people like Bill. And now we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 50% of people like Bill. So that's quite an improvement. We got a long way to go, but it has opened the door not only on treating melanoma, but many other cancers. It used to be just melanoma. Now it's spreading into other types.
Give us a primer. Why is how is immunotherapy different than other kinds of treatments?
Yeah, so I think everybody's familiar with treating cancer by surgery. You know, if you find it and you cut it out before it spreads, you can cure it. Radiation, sometimes very helpful, but those treatments just treat the disease in one part of the body. So people have heard of chemotherapy. The concept there is you poison the cancer directly. Unfortunately, there's collateral damage. Normal organs are injured by the poisons and people are sick. And there's a limit to how much we can treat with poison because people can only take so much. So for hundreds of years, people have conceived of the idea of using the body's own natural immune defense system to fight cancer. And people have been working on this for at least the last 110, 20 years. And the idea here is that we don't treat the cancer, we treat the immune system to treat the cancer. And when it works, the immune system has a memory, and so the results can be very durable.
If you'd like to join the conversation about melanoma, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Carmen, who is at greatest risk of melanoma?
So it depends on the age group. Clearly, Caucasians are at greatest risk. And women under 50 have a higher risk than men, but once we hit 65 years of age, the risk of melanoma in men doubles that of women.
Do we know why?
It's thought that the activity of women with either tanning beds or natural sunlight increases their risk early on, but then men catch up with either outdoor work or spending more time outdoors without sunscreen on.
All right. Well, you're talking about sunscreen and UV, and I understand there's a little bit of a debate about whether UV causes melanoma. Has that debate been put to bed?
Yeah, I don't know that there's much of a debate about UV and melanoma. UV clearly causes melanoma. There are certain types of melanoma that are not as UV dependent. And so Dr. Aronson had brought up certain kinds of melanoma found in different areas. Those rarer types of melanoma may not be UV dependent, but the most common types of melanoma certainly are.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. In Bill's case, under his armpit, I read this morning that this can happen on the bottom of your foot, an area that's not exposed to, the sole of your foot is not usually exposed to too much sunlight.
Absolutely. So there are a few different risk factors for melanoma. One is multiple moles. We say basically greater than 50 moles or atypical moles. Family history of melanoma is a risk factor. Your immune status is a risk factor, and that kind of gets at the immune therapy. If your immune system is depressed, you have a higher risk of cancer and melanoma. And then the one modifiable risk factor is UV exposure. And it's thought that this causes about 95% of the melanomas.
Wow. If you have a family history, if a parent or a grandparent has been diagnosed with melanoma, ought you be doing something differently than the rest of us?
It's a good question. It depends on who you ask and what your other risk factors are. But certainly self-skin exams is important. And if you notice anything new or changing, it should be brought to the attention of your physician or dermatologist. But not everyone who has a grandfather who has had melanoma needs a skin check.
All right. I understand there's some research into possibly, Fred, coming up with a vaccine for melanoma. It seems counterintuitive, but research underway. What's the thinking behind that and how close are we?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people think of vaccines as things you take to prevent a disease, and we would love to have vaccines to prevent cancer, but vaccine research now is designed to help other types of treatment use the immune system to treat active cancer as opposed to prevent it. And certainly if one day we have very effective vaccines that work in the advanced stages of the disease, then it would be time to test them to see if they can prevent disease.
All right. And the other thing making headlines right now is a link between aspirin and, in men, increased risk of melanoma. Is this something that you think has got some credence?
Well, you know, that was the most recent study. There's also been previous studies to show that it actually prevents against skin cancer. So it's hard to know where it's going to eventually end up. If you're taking aspirin for other conditions such as heart disease, it's important to keep taking your aspirin. But it is also important to avoid UV exposure.
I've heard that if you got sunburns as a kid, you're at heightened risk. Is that true or a myth?
No, that's absolutely true. So if you've had five or more sunburns, your risk of melanoma is up 80%.
So
blistering sunburns. Yeah.
Blistering sunburns. Okay, because so many of us, especially people in Maine, have gone out that first day, nice day of summer on an annual basis and gotten a sunburn. Bill, what would you tell others in a similar situation who find themselves diagnosed with melanoma?
Well, two things. First, you mentioned the blistering sunburns, and while we'll never be 100% sure what caused my melanoma, I can vouch for being a member of the Blistering Sunburn Club. I grew up in a family of eight kids. My poor mother would take us to the beach, and she'd be so busy, you know, changing diapers or whatever, that the rest of us would be running around unprotected, and that night you could hear us all groaning with the sunburns. And so I look back on that, and I think, wow, if I knew then what I know now, it would we'd have handled things differently. So I'm a big believer in prevention and in screening and covering up, which I do a lot now. But the other thing I would say, especially to people facing this right now, is I found myself in what I thought two or three times during this whole situation, in what I thought were hopeless situations. And what has amazed me, and I don't want to present false hope to people, but I thought many times that this was going to end badly, and I'm here. It hasn't. And I think a big part of that is finding a doctor like Dr. Aronson, who we did a little – we were out there kind of on a cliff at times in determining what the treatment was going to be and in stopping one treatment and starting another. But I guess that taught me, and the past 2 years has taught me, to just not give up. I mean, there's a lot happening with immunotherapy right now. I remember when I started on ipilimumab and later nivolumab, commonly known as Opdivo, there were still things going on at the regulatory level that were happening in real time with the progression of my disease. So things are happening very quickly, and as Dr. Aronson said, the numbers are changing and they're continuing to change for the better.
All right. We do need to take a quick break. We're discussing melanoma. When we come back, your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Ronan Farrow talks about his Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting on how Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed and assaulted actresses. We'll also talk about attempts to suppress the story by threatening Farrow as well as those actresses. And we'll discuss his new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio is taking part in a national survey on the current and changing media habits of public radio listeners around the country, and we need your help. You may be among randomly chosen listeners who recently received an email from Rob Holt, our Director of Digital, asking you to take this national survey, looking into how you use radio, social media, smartphones, tablets, streaming on the internet to stay connected. If you deleted the email or you didn't receive the survey, but you'd like to take it, you can find it on our website at mainpublic.org. Just click on the We Need Your Help box on the homepage. And thanks for taking the time to do so. The survey will allow us at Maine Public Radio to better serve you in the years ahead.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what you need to know about melanoma. Joining me, Bill Nemitz, who writes for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram and is undergoing treatment for melanoma. Fred Aronson, an oncologist with New England Cancer Specialists, Carmen Rinaldi, a dermatopathologist with Dermatology Associates. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to calls and emails, though, Bill, I have to ask you about the astronaut story.
Yes,
and I don't know what I'm getting in for.
Well, I'm going to jump in and say you were right. I was wrong. I was diagnosed 3 years ago. It just shows how much time flies when you're having fun. But the astronaut story, back when I was going into treatment, as I said, a lot of this stuff was new. The combinations of drugs were new. My history with CLL was certainly new. So I was presenting kind of an interesting case. And in conclusion to laying out our treatment strategy, Dr. Aronson looked at me and said, "You're an astronaut," meaning here we go into the unknown. And what struck me about what he didn't realize was if I weren't a journalist, my alter career would have been astronaut. And it touched such a chord. I almost fell at his feet. I said, "Really? I'm an astronaut now?" That kind of guided me throughout the whole early stages of the treatment, that I felt like I was doing something daring and exciting.
Well, let me ask you this, Fred. Has medicine learned from Bill's case?
Yeah, absolutely. When he was getting started, we really had no idea whether his leukemia problem and prior chemotherapy for leukemia would make our treatments not work. They are bad for the immune system. We're depending on his immune system to treat his cancer. So there was no information about whether this would work or not. And it was one of the reasons why I said, you know, this is like, astronauts, they don't know what's coming. It's not a routine thing to get in a space capsule. So actually, there's an update on that for Bill. He hasn't heard this yet. Last December at a national meeting, the Australians, who have a big interest in melanoma because there's a lot of fair-skinned and sun-sensitive people living close to the equator, they actually did a national study to look and see about what happens if you have CLL and you have melanoma and you get these treatments. And that's the first I've heard of an organized study of your problem. And they actually found similar results in the patients who'd had CLL, unless they had the chemo that you had, and then they didn't do quite as well.
Wow. So yeah. I'm further out in space than we thought.
So you're fortunate in many ways.
I think, Bill, we might hear from some of your readers on this.
Yeah.
We have a tweet from Steve. "I had a mole checked out that sounds exactly like the bad version, large, growing, irregular, in two colors, but was told it was a sebaceous keratoma." Is that? You're shaking your head.
It was probably a seborrheic keratosis, and that is a benign growth that most people over the age of 30 have, and they look concerning. They're raised, they're brown or black, and they change. And so oftentimes they get confused with melanoma, and we see that frequently.
Okay. We'll go to Mitra calling from Farmington. If my clicker will click. There we go. Hi, Mitra. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So my journey with melanoma started actually in 2011 when there was a mole on the back of my calf and I had the excision done, and then I kind of just proceeded with my life and I didn't really make any changes. I didn't do anything. And it turned out that it was just outside the margins. And for 2 years, it traveled basically through my body, infecting every lymph node that it came into contact with. So then 2 years later, which was 4 years ago, I got it has recurred. Our rural hospital here in Farmington, Maine, sent me down to Boston, and that's where my treatment began, and it was really successful. But melanoma is so clever that with most treatments, it kind of figures its way around it. And so I've had sort of a waxing and waning of my tumors. But then last year, I was one of the people lucky enough to get into a clinical trial to get the vaccine. And that involves taking a piece of a tumor and then turning that into your own personal vaccine. And then I received 28 vaccinations over, I think, a 7-week period. And unfortunately for me, it didn't work. Now I have tumors everywhere that I got vaccinations.
Mm. Thoughts?
So this brings up the subject of clinical trials and when things don't go well and even when things are going well. So we always like to think when we're starting out on this journey, whether it's in a rocket ship or not, that, you know, every person's problem is special to them and to us as the people taking care of them. And the question is, what's the best treatment? And so we have treatments that have been around for 30 years that are not great, and we have treatments that have been around for 5 or 10 years that are pretty good. And then we're working all the time to make new and better treatments and to make the old ones work better. So the question always is, do we try something that's brand new and in development? We don't know what the results will be in the future because we're not there yet, clinical trials, or do we go with something that's been around for a few years and looks good? So that's a judgment, and it's a balancing of risks and benefits and hoped for outcomes for the individual, and also to be in a clinical trial and experiment in Boston or in Portland or in any of our other offices. You have to qualify, means you have to fit into the group that we're testing our hypothesis in. So we always think of clinical trials and experimental treatment options. It's hard to hear that somebody's not doing well and that the vaccine experiment didn't work in them. There are many types of experimental vaccines and many experimental immunotherapies. In a week or two, the national meeting is coming up, and there's a lot of exciting information that's going to come out in the next couple of weeks about the latest round of experiments.
Mitra, thank you so much for calling in, and good luck to you. We have an email from Todd. I have a suspect dark spot that has been developing over the past year and have made an appointment with a dermatologist to have it removed. However, the appointment is not until September. Is that soon enough? Boy, big issue in Maine that, you know, it's hard to get an appointment with a dermatologist. Is that soon enough?
It's an interesting question. So access to care is an important consideration for new and changing moles. And what our group does is that, you know, with routine stuff, we have a fairly long waiting list a few months out. But if you have a worrisome lesion, you bring it to the attention of your primary doctor. If they call, they're usually appointments within a week or two.
So you'd recommend him to call his primary care doctor and push harder for a quicker appointment?
Yes.
Okay, great. We'll go to Ginger calling from Falmouth. Hi, Ginger. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've had two rounds of melanoma. One of them was amelanotic, which was a little freaky. But I have been on Imuran for another condition for about 16 years. So I'm immunosuppressed. And there's been some discussion about that potentially being involved in me having melanoma. So I was interested in that, an answer to that. And also, I'm 60, so at this point in my life, how much does covering up matter, or was the damage done when I was on the beach as a child? Thank you.
So a lot of important points there. People who have one melanoma are at higher risk for getting another one. You mentioned amelanotic, so that reminds me to point out to people that not all melanomas look like melanomas. A significant fraction of melanomas were not suspected to be that before the biopsy was done. And then the question of Imuran, that's one of the drugs that does suppress the immune system, and all of those drugs and other conditions that suppress the immune system increase the risk of getting melanoma. So, you know, if you had sunburns as a youngster and then you take immunosuppressive drugs or for some other reason have impairment of your immune system, your risk of melanoma is going to be higher. We don't yet really have a group of people who are at such high risk that just because they have a risk that they get mandatory skin checks, although people with organ transplants, they routinely see a dermatologist, not so much for melanoma, but for the other types of skin cancer. So, and then the last part of this was?
Ginger, what was the second part of your question?
Yeah, I'm 60, and I really do cover myself up from the sun, but I wonder how much does that make a difference, or did I do the damage as a child?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. So I used to think that it didn't matter, and because the data about risk of sun exposure and melanoma are mostly exposures early in life, but and less so as an adult. So, but there was an experiment done in Australia, comes up again, They took 1,600 people at risk, and half of them got all the sun lotion they wanted for free, and the other half did whatever they normally did. And over a period of years, the frequency of melanoma and other types of skin cancer was about half in the group, and these were adults over the age of 25. So there's evidence from that study, which wasn't a perfect study, that adults using sun blockers and doing sun avoidance and skin protection reduce their risk of subsequent cancers.
Ginger, thanks for your call. From Jim, a tweet, and I may pronounce this wrong, I have vitiligo, so I have white spots where I don't tan. I've been told that I'm at higher risk for skin cancer and also that I'm protected against it. What's the truth?
So vitiligo is a condition in which is an autoimmune condition where your lymphocytes, your white blood cell count, white blood cells attack your pigment-making cells. And so you have white areas or absence of melanocytes in those spots. Now, melanocytes, while they are the cancerous cells in melanoma, they also protect your skin against UV exposure by darkening your skin. And so he is at increased risk for melanoma because he doesn't make the pigment to protect his skin.
All right. Go ahead.
So there's another half to that, which is interesting. So people who have melanoma, who get immunotherapy, who get vitiligo, do better. And they have a higher rate of cure with immunotherapy. It means the treatment is working because we can see the immune system is turned on to attack the pigment cells in the normal pigment cells.
So back to the very beginning of the program, some of the mysteries of this disease.
There are a lot of interesting little bits and pieces, and that's one of them. We actually described that in Boston a long time ago. A patient who had treatment had a mole and developed a lack of pigment in his normal skin and around the mole. And this was the beginning of proof that what we're doing when we treat the immune system, we think we're treating the immune system and not the cancer directly. And how do we prove that? And this is one of those pieces of evidence.
Bob on Facebook writes, all best wishes to Bill Nemitz in his battle with cancer. Please know many of us value your contributions as a journalist, a citizen, an esteemed member of the greater Portland and Maine community. Bob,
well, thank you very much.
If best wishes and prayers could be scientifically studied, I think you have lots of them coming with you on this journey. We're going to go to Ward in Gardner. Hi, Ward. Go ahead.
Yes, I had a mole biopsied several years ago, and it was benign. And I was wondering, and it's still growing slowly, but not very, very much. I was wondering how soon after the first biopsy, like 1 year, 5 years, should I have it re-biopsied?
Great question.
So if you had a mole removed and it was read out by the dermatopathologist as being benign, it's likely a benign mole that was left behind that repigmented. There is also a chance that it wasn't a benign mole, and that's why it recurred. And so it's difficult to speak specifically to your question, but if a mole repigments, typically we do remove it if there is any question.
All right. Thank you, Ward, and good luck to you. We have an email from Elle. Can you have Dr. Rinaldi explain the difference between basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas and melanoma and whether all three can be accurately described as melanoma?
So all three are not melanoma. So basal cell and squamous cell are the much more common, we call non-melanoma skin cancers, and basal cell being the most common. And all three are secondary to UV exposure, melanoma being the most deadly. So they're all very different cancers of different parts of the skin and have a different sort of outcome.
Jen, I should note that since my diagnosis with melanoma, I, at Dr. Aronson's urging, finally went to a dermatologist, and on a number of occasions since then have had basal and squamous cells detected and removed. So, this is kind of what happened with the CLL, too, where you're focusing on one cancer and you forget that there can be others. So I think it's very important for people to bring in that dermatology component and be checked on a regular basis.
I'm going to go to Ryan calling from Scarborough. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
I'm 31 years old. I had cancer or a case of melanoma 7 or 8 years ago now, and it was a T2 aggressive melanoma on my arm. And I had known about it and seen it for years, and it started just like a little looked like a mole, and then it kept changing a little bit, and I showed it to my doctor. He said, don't worry about it. And I lived with it for like 2 years, and then I finally went and got a biopsy and was diagnosed. Anyway, long story short, I asked my oncologist if they thought that it could be from working with chemicals. And I've worked with, you know, with various chemicals, woodworking and working with composites my whole life. And they said, no, no way. And I was just really surprised to hear that. And then I've asked my dermatologist multiple times if it could be from that. And he said, no. And I just wanted to hear if you thought that is the case.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And Ryan, you were, it sounds like if I'm doing math in my head correctly, you were 24 or 25 when you were diagnosed.
Yeah, exactly.
So a couple of things. One is that we do look for other causes of melanoma, but haven't found them in, for example, say, paper mill workers or chemical workers or people who work in the atomic energy industry. So that's how we look for signals of, did the chemicals cause your melanoma? Whereas the links to ultraviolet light and sunburning are very clear. It's kind of like tobacco and lung cancer. There's no question about that. There are other things that cause lung cancer besides smoking, but you have to have a lot of that to find it. And so we haven't had a signal yet about chemical exposures. And then other half of this?
That was really it, but I'm surprised that he was diagnosed at age 24. Is that unusual?
So that's really important. So this is one of the most common cancers in young adults. We don't often see it in children. But occasionally there are inheritable forms of melanoma or risk for melanoma that do occur in children. Typically, it's late teenage years and beyond. One of the interesting things is that most cancers are rare to be seen in people under the age of 25 or 30. And melanoma, we not infrequently see it in late teens and early 20s. It's actually one of the leading causes of cancer death in young adults.
Mm. Ryan, thank you so much for calling in. We do have to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We're discussing melanoma. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Roosevelt Campobello International Park, inviting you to take the all-new fun tour, opening May 26th. Visit FDR.net. Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. And Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences. On the next Speaking in Maine, we visit the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations.
If we had a 10% decline in real wages in the U.S., we would all be out on the streets with pitchforks demanding our congresspeople's heads. But in Russia, there's been nothing of the sort.
Chris Miller is a professor of international history at Tufts University. He'll discuss his book, Putinomics, Power and Money in Resurgent Russia. That's on the next Speaking in Maine, this afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Congressional investigators say hundreds of millions of dollars of opioids like fentanyl are coming into the U.S. by mail.
How many more people have to die before our own Postal Service takes the measures that we know can be taken to be able to stop these poisons?
I'm Audie Cornish. Why opioids are so easy to order by mail and so hard to stop? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what we know about melanoma. Joining me today, Carmen Rinaldi is with Dermatology Associates, Fred Aronson with New England Cancer Specialists, and Bill Nemitz with the Portland Press Herald. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Cody. I've heard chemical-based sunblocks are being found unsafe. Can you comment on chemical sunblock versus mineral sunblock versus no sunblock? And Dr. Rinaldi, this is part of an even bigger question. Is sunblock enough?
Yeah, that's it's a good question. So we can get into first the ways to protect your skin against the sun. Sunscreen is just one component of that. There's also seeking the shade between 10 and 2 when the sun's rays are the highest, to wear sun protective clothing, to use caution around water, snow, and sand. And then also avoiding tanning beds. And then the other factor is sunscreen. And so the American Academy of Dermatology recommends SPF 30 or greater. That's water resistant and broad spectrum. Should apply it a few minutes before going out, they say 15, and then every 2 hours while outdoors. And most people fault on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then after swimming or excessively sweating, you're supposed to reapply it right after that.
And how about this? You know, I've seen these reports as well that a lot of the chemical-based sunblocks might be hormone disruptors. So yeah. That's kind of scary.
So that's an interesting thing. There have never been any human studies to suggest any toxicity or harm to humans from any of these chemicals. These were all in vitro studies or on animals or in test tubes. And the chemical which you bring up is oxybenzone, and that's thought of as being a hormone disruptor. And to get the concentration which they had in this study, you would have to apply 6% of the oxybenzone for 277 years. And then you get the estrogenetic effects of it. And so clearly that's not going to happen. The other chemical or component is this retinal palmitate, which is a vitamin A derivative. And it has nothing to do with sunscreen or sunblock, but it's used in sunscreens for an oxidative effect and photo protection.
Well, and how about the whole concern about those of us here in Maine? My doctor told me almost nobody in Maine gets enough vitamin D.
So that's a very good question. So there's safe ways to get vitamin D through diet or supplementation. And the sun is not a safe way to do it.
All right. We'll go to Helen, who's calling from Warren. Hi, Helen. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm right checking out at Lowe's as we speak. Yes, my mother was diagnosed when she was 90 with a melanoma under her armpit, and she had it excised, and there was no recurrence. She died of heart disease, old age, basically, at 95 and a half. However, my sister, who has had CLL for 20 years, developed melanoma when she was 67. Between her toes, again, where the sun never shines.
Go ahead. Did you have a question?
Sorry. Yes, and so I just wondered if you all are familiar with, she's been a part of a clinical trial at UVA in Virginia with Craig Swingluff for a vaccine. She's also been on Pembro or Keytruda, as the public knows it. And unfortunately, it hasn't done any good. She was clear for 5 years, asymptomatic, and then it recurred in a lymph node in her thigh, and now it's gone to her lung, et cetera. So just wondering about the association between CLL and melanoma, and Kate, opposed to this drugs that Bill, I guess his name, the journalist, was on.
Yeah, so as we mentioned earlier, one of the risk factors for getting melanoma is trouble with your immune system, and CLL disrupts part of your immune system. A lot of people think the immune system is one thing. I have to point out it's a lot of things. I think of it as like the military. There are many branches. So CLL disrupts part of that. Some of the drugs that we treat CLL with disrupt other parts of the immune system. And so whenever you start to do that, the risk goes up. And most melanoma is in the sun-exposed areas, but the non-sun-exposed areas, the risk there is also going to go up. A lot of the mutations that we see in melanoma that drive the cancer are different in different locations, but the ones in the foot are similar to the ones in the skin with sun exposure. And so in terms of the drugs that your sister is receiving and what's been going on and the program down at University of Virginia. First of all, it's an excellent program, and they've been very interested in the immunology of melanoma and developing vaccines, so it's a very good program. And again, vaccines remain experimental, and when they don't work, then we turn to other things. You mentioned Pembro, which is like the Nivo that Bill got. Again, these things don't work in everybody, and we had to actually, in Bill's case, give him a drug called ipilimumab first, and when that didn't work, we then gave him the drug that's similar to the one that your sister got, and I think we were very fortunate to see that work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more than one of these modern immunodrugs that she might be getting, and I hope that she's able to benefit from treatment.
Jen, I think what Dr. Aronson says about the immune system has really been the overriding roller coaster for me. When I've had difficulty, first with the ipilimumab and then much later with the nivolumab, it's not the cancer. that's making life difficult. It's an immune system that is reacting to the therapy. So if I were to list off all the various side effects that I struggled with, they're all attributable to an immune system that is either in overdrive or gone haywire. So I think it's a critical part of it for people to understand. It's not when you're not feeling well, it's not necessarily the cancer that's getting to you. You just have to endure the treatment.
Helen, thanks for your call. Email from Tracy. Just wanted to make your listeners aware of the Patient Navigator program at Maine Health. I'm the navigator for melanoma patients across the Maine Health system. Things nurse navigators do: serve as main point of contact, explain treatment options, provide information, and find resources.
Hear, hear.
Thank you, Tracy. Let's see. We'll go to Joel, who's calling from Albion. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions for you. I grew up in Arizona from age 5, and I left about when I was about 54. Anyway, nobody ever talked about sunscreen when I was a kid. So numerous sunburns, which you just wrote off as what it was like to live in Phoenix. But I've had numerous actinic keratosis that have been removed from my arm, temple, et cetera. And I just wondered where actinic keratosis fit in, because oftentimes you can't even see these. You really have to kind of feel them. I've been to dermatologists, and sometimes they don't feel that it's worth taking off. But that was one question. Vitamin D was another. The amount of vitamin D you should take here in the winter. And so I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Joel. Actinic keratosis, what is that?
So actinic keratosis are precancerous lesions, and they're thought to be precursors to the squamous cell carcinoma. It's also fertile soil, because this is areas of actinic damage that you've had a lot of sun exposure in the past. And so we do typically treat them. We quote 1 to 15% go on to form squamous cell carcinomas, but it's a sign of having a lot of sun exposure in the past.
Okay, and this is something tangentially you wanted to talk about, Fred, is that we're talking about melanoma here today, which is the most serious form of skin cancer, but it is not nearly as frequent as squamous cell and other forms of cancer, correct?
Yeah. The latest statistics are 3.3 million new non-melanoma skin cancers in the U.S. this year and about 90,000 melanoma skin cancers in the U.S. So that's a huge difference.
All right. We'll go to Elaine calling from Augusta. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was told that if you have a diagnosis of ulcerative colitis, you're at increased risk for skin cancer and melanoma. Is it the nature of the autoimmune disease, or more likely the treatments for the ulcerative colitis that puts you at greater risk? And I'll take it off the line.
So I think from what I know of this, it's mostly the treatments. I think people with autoimmune disease also have a slightly higher risk of other kinds of cancer, lymphoma being the most common one that we see in people who haven't been treated for their autoimmune disease with immunosuppressive drugs. Melanoma, I think the risk would be marginally higher just from having that diagnosis if you didn't need immunosuppressive treatments, but the big issue comes from some of the drugs that are very effective in controlling the disease. And again, you know, if you have one of these dilemmas of I have a disease that needs treatment that might increase my risk of some other disease, that's what we always face in medicine. Bill mentioned side effects from the treatment. You know, the treatment works by turning on the immune system or turning the brakes off of the immune system, to be technical. And so there's side effects where the immune system attacks normal tissues. And in your case, your immune system is attacking your bowel and causing those problems. So you must treat that, and then you must be alert to the risks that go along with having the disease and having the treatment.
Elaine, thanks for your call. Moving on to Freeport and Julie. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi. My husband was diagnosed with malignant melanoma, it was probably 25 years ago. It was, the doctor operated on it, got clear margins. He's been checked ever since and has not had any problems. Is there anything else he should be doing other than just getting checked?
So it gets back to the sun protected measures that I discussed before, seeking shade between 10 and 2, using sunblock, avoiding tanning beds, and using sun protective clothing. Also, checking his own skin, we say about once a month for people who have melanoma or once a year for people who haven't.
All right. Thanks, Julie. Good luck to him. It sounds great. 25 years. Wow. We've got a Carol calling from Manchester. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Calling in. I'm a retired hairdresser now, but over the last 12 years or so, I've discovered two melanomas on two of my clients, one of which was my husband. And so I just wanted to make people aware that if you're in the chair and your hairdresser is pointing something out to you that might look suspicious, then take it to heart and do a follow-up. But my question actually is about basal and squamous cancer. I've noted a number of times over the years, particularly along the ridge of the ear, I've seen basal skin cancer, and I just didn't know how serious that really is. Is it ever fatal, or is it just something that needs treatment?
So basal cell is rarely fatal. More commonly, it's locally destructive, and it forms a non-healing sore that can get infected or cause tissue destruction. And so it should be treated and completely removed, but it is, again, very rarely fatal.
All right. And Carol, thanks for your call. It's interesting that you say that you've been, as a hairdresser, observing the skin of your clients, because that's sort of a big move right now today, isn't it, Dr. Aronson, to train hairdressers in identifying.
Absolutely, and thank you for helping that way. Everybody who's looking at everybody else, it doesn't have to be your partner. It can be your doctor. It can be, some of my golf buddies. I've found two of them who have melanoma from playing golf with them.
Yeah, and I saw an article from the Today Show about an Instagram photo that somebody had said, an Instagram follower, I'm worried about what's on your grandfather's forehead. Go ahead.
About one half of melanomas are self-detected. And so it's important to keep an eye on your skin and keep an eye on your colleagues or friends, spouses, children's skin as well.
If you live alone, I read another story this morning that, married couples are diagnosed more frequently, which makes a lot of sense because, you have someone looking at your back and things like that. Do you recommend having a friend take a glance at your
Absolutely.
Back?
Absolutely. And mirrors as well. And if you go to spotskincancer.org, they explain how to do the self-skin exam and techniques and how to perform that.
Okay. And we just have a few seconds left. We haven't brought up tanning beds. How bad are they?
Very bad. And so I'll just say one stat. If you use a tanning bed once, it increases your risk of melanoma by 20%.
Mm. And if you use it regularly,
it increases it more than that.
Mm, okay. Well, thank you all three for being here, hopefully helping people go in for an early diagnosis or protect themselves. Bill Kimmett's a columnist for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, is undergoing treatment for melanoma. Dr. Frederick Aronson, an oncologist with New England Cancer Specialist, and Dr. Carmen Rinaldi, a dermatopathologist with Dermatology Associates. Roddy Nickbor ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.